Session number 16690. Mr. Peter Frank, reel 5 on this side. Reel 6 follows after a short pause. Left channel is informant's mic only. Right channel, informant plus interviewer.
Mr. Frank, reel 5.
From Macala military airfield, at least I think it was Kala. I guess it was Kala for another term, precisely where we were. They're taking it at night to military camp at Windermere, which apparently had been occupied by Polish soldiers or possibly by prisoners of war before, I don't know. And of course, I still couldn't get about. The boys, and Otto Jakubowicz will probably tell you, had managed to get outside the boundaries of the camp, or on the fringe of the camp, was a lake. And it was a very Indian summer indeed. Absolutely beautiful weather.
This is September, by the way.
Yes, September, I think. September, I think 14th of September or something like that, of 1945. And my father came and collected me on the third day and took me to register police in Windermere. And this is where I acquired my L to the signature, because there's a big typical Lancastrian village constable virtually filling the room, sort of 6 foot 6 and shoulders like that. And he said yes, and so far I explained to him. My English was minimal. Of course I've been speaking French, German, Polish and everything, but hardly any English during the war, during my time when I was actually incarcerated. And he said, what's your name? Father started to tell me, he said, I'm talking to him. So I said, Peter Frank. And I said, looked at me, Paul's, my father. He said, I asked you what your name was. He said, Peter Frank. And what the bloody hell's your surname? He expected another name after Peter Frank. And I had problems with that for quite some time. And by the time I'd been to school for a while, I decided to use the Leo. I still get letters now. Frank Peters, recently, dear Mr. Leo. So it's very difficult. But then my father had moved from Southport to Macclesfield because another relative lived there, so it was second cousin. And they had a daughter, and I stayed with them. And of course, Macclesfield had a good school. So I was presented to the headmaster of King's School, where he would take me. And he asked me what I knew. I said, well, I've been to an official school since the age of 11, and I did some private lessons. So he tried me at some fifth form math, and I was up to it. It's absolutely unbelievable if you think that what they taught me privately in that short period of time. So I went into a law fifth at King's, and that was difficult. You know, for somebody who dealt with day-to-day life-threatening decisions, who felt as old as Methuselah, and who had the experience of other people's many lives, to pretend to be a schoolboy was exceedingly difficult. I eventually managed to ride a bike, but I still couldn't walk. And I rode to school, and I rode back at lunchtime, not for food, but to smoke, because as soon as the war finished and military medical people came, tranquilizers didn't exist. That's when we all started having something of a nervous breakdown. And I was medically advised to smoke. Of course, by the time I came to England, I was addicted to the weed. So I continued smoking till I was 44. The wisdom to be in the But at school, it took a long time to adjust. But I had absolutely no difficulty with the staff. I had no difficulty with the boys. I gave my lecture by the form master, who was a fantastic guy, who told them exactly where I came from, that I had difficulty in the language, and that I needed all the assistance possible. And the boys were wonderful, but very good friends. And I got invited to their homes. Then we became very good mates, and as I got fitter and fitter, we used to then go places. But that's much later, because, of course, I spent more of my time learning. I had a math master, an excellent English, French presented no problems at school. But the sciences did. By this time I decided not to be a diplomat, but to be a surgeon, and particularly to be an orthopedic surgeon. Now, as soon as I had minor operation while I was in camp at Dora with a doctor. He removed some of their toes and cleaned the thing up. One of the assistants, who was just an orderly, stuck a blunt end of a scalpel between two toes to keep them separate. Little jokes like that. Bandages consisted of exposed films, which had thrown away. A remarkable piece of equipment, because, like paper, they are sterile. Very difficult for bugs to live on reels of film. But that's tremendously difficult to apply. So I learned my bandaging there to perfection. And then when I came to Prague, I went to the hospital where my grandfather used to be, that's why I went there. And they probably wanted to amputate both my feet. Can't tell you on this day what I told them. Well, I went to another clinic, and they just treated me by dressings. It was a very nice young doctor who asked me what I wanted to be, and I said, an orthopedic surgeon, and he laughed. He said, you'll never be able to stand. So we got a piece of my mind. And then, when I came to England, the local doctor sent me to the Royal Infirmary in Manchester to see Harry Plant, who was a doyen of orthopedic surgery. Was the first secretary of the British Orthopedic Association in 1915-16, something like that. Manchester was the cradle of orthopedic surgery, not British wise, but worldwide. Together with Liverpool, we started with the building of Manchester Jet Canal. That's where orthopedic surgery was born. But that's another story. I went to see him privately at Long Street. He wasn't there, a female assistant was there. And I didn't hit it off with her at all, but managed to persuade her that we leave matters for a year, and that I would be treated in Macclesfield Hospital just conservatively, hoping that the stump will heal up spontaneously, which it of course didn't. And then when I actually saw Harry Platt, almost a year later. Very interesting experience. He looked at me and my father. It was in the morning, never got up. And then he said, well, I suppose the best thing is if we take a bit of that foot off. And I said to him, well, I wouldn't like that very much because that's going to interfere with my balance, isn't it, sir? I spoke English badly, but I spoke English. He said, I suppose so. Well, how do you propose to treat it then? So I told him. Showed him an X-ray. Because of my foot, a bony arch had developed right across the open ends of the bases of the remainder of the toes. And I had a feeling that what was left of the base of the big toe could be mobilized. So I suggested that that be done. And perhaps a skin graft taken. He said, that's a good idea. Shook my hand. I went to the infirmary. Eventually, after God knows how many days waiting, they did the operation. He used to take the whole group of students and doctors around when he frostbite. It doesn't happen every day in England. Nobody knew how to treat him. And I used to give a lecture on my feet.
How old were you then?
And it was very amusing. And one day somebody came down who thought that he knew it all and came to see me and brought the students around before Harry came. And he said to the self-important fellow, I would advise you to shut up. The patient knows more about his feet than all of us put together. So virtually treating my feet myself after that, he discharged me and said, come back if you ever want anything. I can help you. He knew I was going to do medicine. I didn't go back because I felt that I would like to make my grave on my own rather than on the back of one of the most famous surgeons in this country. And of course, became president of the Royal College of Surgeons and president of this, that, and the other. Knighted, of course. And many years passed and I qualified. Walking down the corridor of Manchester Royal Infirmary, coming on duty, the young SHO, Harry comes limping, he had a tuberculous knee in his youth, which was arthrodesed, and that decided that he will be an orthopedic surgeon instead of a concert pianist, but I mean either, fabulous pianist. And he hadn't seen me for 7 years. Hi, Frank. I said, well, sir, how are you? He said, I notice that you have made it without my help. And I saw him from time to time at functions. He's a very old man. And then, when I became consultant, sort of get allowed into the inner sanctum, I got to know him, really, on a sort of doctor-to-doctor basis. I mean, obviously, deferring to him. But we had a great deal of, if I can say, common. In every sense, he was mountains superior to all of us. He had a totally photographic memory. He spoke perfect French, German. Material on learned subjects. He was an international personage. But I had a very big motor car by then, and he could get into a motor vehicle, so I used to transport him. So it was one cripple transporting another. And eventually he came to my house, and by this time I had a lot of people befriended in the legal profession and artists, some very nice evenings at home. And then he published an article about me, about my feet anyway, not about me. And eventually, I used to come and collect him quite often because he became more and more incapacitated. And lived on the second floor of a building without lifts. And then came the time when he was due to become convent, and we gave him a test lift. By this time, the hospital in which I'd been a consultant had become the university hospital by virtue of a professor being transferred to there rather than the infirmary, purely fortuitous. And Professor Garasco, who's still Professor now, arranged this, and I arranged the social side of it. And I had a portrait made of Plant, my friend of mine, Harold Lowry, a very famous painter, who again came out of the army shortly after the war from the parachute regiment with his dog, and we became close mates, and I was one of the first people to buy a painting from him, and so on and so forth. His successor to the army. So through the war, I got to know this very famous man, Harry Platt, first as a patient, then as a mentor when I was already a maid, so to speak. Then I looked after him, in a way, and we became very, very good friends. And he managed to survive his 100th birthday, where he gave the most lucid speech imaginable, and 4 months later died.
Coming back to your own experiences in Britain, it must have seemed like Toy Town after what you'd experienced.
Macclesfield after the war, unbelievable. I mean, it was as if the war had never happened. I mean, I think they lost one or two bombs when they were bombing Manchester. But basically, the town was unchanged, and we lived in a terraced house with two old maids next door who behaved like something out of Jane Eyre. Totally incomprehending as to what happened, and I thought I was living in a lunatic asylum, and obviously wanted to go back to Prague initially. And gradually, of course, as I began to speak the language, understand the people, I suddenly realized that the British people stood for all that I stood for.
What was that?
Well, personal liberty, freedom of expression, leaving people alone, trying to help others without actually being forced to do so. When I started being interested in cricket, I never played cricket, it was a football. I think it's very important that if you live in Britain, or anywhere, that you should absorb the local culture. But again, you see, I was the right age. And I cannot stress that enough, that it's not a question of generation in this case, it's actually a number of years. Had I been younger, I would not have survived. Had I been older, I probably wouldn't have survived either. But because I was 10 when the whole joke started, I could assimilate it, I could adapt to it. Because I was a sportsman, and adaptable, because I had all these opportunities to see what was going to happen, I could adjust to it. Then you developed a sort of sixth sense and reflex, getting out of trouble. And that, of course, allowed me to adapt here as well, in a totally different way. I mean, there's so much rubbish talked about the effect of various forms of media and culture. culture, our culture of young people. I'm absolutely convinced, looking at not just me, people with my background, of my age group, because we grew up in extremely privileged circumstances. What is frequently forgotten is that Czechoslovakia, and particularly Bohemia, before the war, was an exceedingly democratic, wealthy, highly cultural country. So we had a very, very stable background. And that was formed by the age of 10 and 11 and could not be destroyed. So I had this sort of easygoing, you know, Czech was black, white, green, made no difference to us. Certainly not to us, young people. And then I came to England with some languages behind me. Good cultural background, because I did a lot of reading, I was encouraged to read. When you're oppressed, you've got nothing else to do. Read books, Voltaire, Shakespeare, Goethe, Schiller. In their originals, because when I was having an English lesson, I worked in English, and then in German, I was in German, and also in French. So my general education was much more advanced than a 17-year-old boy in England. So that certainly would stand. And then, of course, the natural adaptability which I've learned made it easier for me to adapt to a circumstance that if I had been taken out of, say that I had stayed in Prague throughout the war and hadn't suffered the privations that I had and been transferred to an English grammar school in Macclesfield, I couldn't have coped. Because don't forget, I had a father who had to be made accustomed to the fact that he had never seen his wife. Till he saw me, he was still hoping that my mother was alive, a very good marriage. It was I who had to break it to him. It was I who had to really support him psychologically, rather than he me. Because nobody could imagine what was going on, what had gone on. And we didn't talk about the details. So, really, all the counselling that I received was for me. You had to take it step by step and adjust to your own circumstance. And again, it's something that I rail against as a surgeon, that if anybody nowadays has the slightest mistake, that he has to be counselled, answered by people who have no personal experience, are usually of a lower than average intellect as far as I can see, and unemployable otherwise, or busybodies. And we are totally ignoring the fact that we are an animal, and that the laws of nature do apply to us, and that there is such a thing as survival of the fittest, and we are weakening our position as a nation by pandering to the weakest. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't help the weakest, but there seems to be a philosophy nowadays that people can't help themselves. When there is concrete evidence throughout history that people in need do learn how to help themselves, provided that they are intelligent enough, that they have had sufficiently good stable background, and are young enough and adaptable. And I think that is a lesson that comes out of that particular war and any other war.
Could I ask you about one thing in settling down in Britain, whether you had the opportunities that you thought you should have had, or whether there was any discrimination against you in any way?
Well, there was discrimination. I didn't believe it at first, but there was. I was accepted to university in Sheffield, and a fabulous interview with the dean, who wrote me a very apologetic letter that the council had rejected my application because there were too many applicants from outside Yorkshire. There's no doubt about it that it was because of the Jew, regarding the Jew. And equally, I didn't get into Manchester that year. And I had an interview. The dean was Sharp, who was on German ecology. Now, I always regarded Sharp as a very broad-minded man, highly cultured, musician. But no effort was made for me to be equated with an ex-military applicant. After all, I came out of the war just as much as any soldier. I did my bit as much as I could. And I felt that, like not any other favoritism, other than that I should be regarded as a soldier, if you like. And eventually I managed to get in the following year, 2 days after the term started. But I think there were a few arms twisted. Behind the doors, so to speak. And I mean arms twisted, it wasn't this is a nice chap and so on. The liberal politician who took interest in it, again I can't remember the name, it's only the scandalous that I wasn't mentioned. And I think there were several threats of publication and so on and so forth. I think, I don't know. But I was officially rejected the second year, and then suddenly I had a telephone call that I'd been accepted because somebody else hadn't been. But Schlapp's attitude to me throughout my stay at the university was alien. Again, with no help, no understanding that I was perhaps fighting under some adversity. That I couldn't live in a hall, I couldn't afford it, still had problems with my feet, I've been there for Macclesfield, but I'm exhausted at home. Living in a continental household wasn't a good idea to study, quite apart from the linguistic problems that it created, because of course at home German was spoken, and my so-called art was Austrian. And if you speak German at home, your English doesn't improve. My English really crystallized. From the accent. When I finally left home altogether, my wife died as a doctor. And then I forgot my German. But German is my second language. For instance, Schlapp failed me in physiology, which was his subject. 49%, 50% was pass. Yeah, you don't do that. Not to simply do that. So, yes, there was. But, and I think that one appointment that I applied for in Manchester, I didn't get because of my background. Not necessarily because the background was Jewish, but it wasn't English. But otherwise, no, again, I mean, when you put the tape, play the tape back, I can hear my accent. But